Hi, I'm Rich Scott, Chief Medical Officer at Genomics England. It's my pleasure today to be guest hosting today's episode of The G Word. We're trying to bring the benefits of genomic medicine to everyone, and that involves accelerating genomic research and also working with the NHS to bring genomics into the heart of healthcare. Genomics is a word that can trigger really strong responses. Hope, fear, anger. And there's a lot of information out there, but it's not all accessible to non-experts. And there are some myths out there. So we want to talk more about this word, the G word, genomics. That's what this podcast is about. Welcome to the G word. So Hilary Martin, welcome to the G word podcast. You're a group leader at the Wellcome Trust Sanger Institute, having spent your postdoc there exploring the genetic architecture of developmental disorders, looking at the role of rare recessive variants and polygenic risk. And before that, you did a PhD in human genetics at Oxford. And now your research is looking at the genetic architecture of rare and common disease in diverse populations. It's great to have you on the show, and I'm really looking forward to talking to you about some of these topics.
Thanks for the invitation.
I'm really interested to hear how you came into this career in genetics and looking at the questions you are.
Well, I was very lucky. I was actually born into a family of geneticists. My parents are both human geneticists, and my grandfather was a geneticist too. So definitely runs in the family. How did I come to Sanger? Well, I did my PhD in Oxford, and part of what I worked on was rare disease, whole genome sequencing. And when I came to Sanger, I came initially to work on the East London Genes and Health Project, which I think we might talk about later. But I quickly also became involved in the Deciphering Developmental Disorders Project, which is also focused on rare disease with large-scale exome sequencing. I'm just interested in how human genetic variation affects risk of disease and non-disease traits as well. And also how we can use it to learn about population history and dynamics.
Fascinating. And so I guess a lot of people listening to this won't have a real feel for the sorts of questions you're trying to ask and answer. For example, thinking about rare and common disease. What are the sorts of questions that are there for you and your group?
Okay, so to give some examples, we ask which genes are involved in particular rare diseases. So what types of mutations in those genes are involved? What's the distribution of genetic variants of different frequencies that contribute? So do only rare variants contribute to risk of rare disorders, or do common variants also contribute? And how do they work together to do that? In common disease, it's similar, but there are some key differences. So this is generally focused on the contribution of common variants, identifying common variants that have effects on disease risk and using those in combination to predict risk and exploring how well those predictions work across ancestry groups has been a focus of part of my group's research for the last couple of years.
And so when you're talking about variants there, you're talking about differences in the DNA sequence.
Correct.
In the genome. Tell us a bit about what that means and how you go about looking at those individual differences in people and beginning to make judgments about whether they might be driving the diseases you're looking at and what that means for you.
So firstly, how do we measure them? So there's kind of two main technologies that we use. One is sequencing, which enables us to read every single letter in the human genome. And we either do that for the whole genome, which is about 3 billion letters long, or we focus on the parts of the genome that encode proteins, which make up only about 1% of the length. So that allows us to find essentially all of the variation. There's some that we miss, but basically all of it. And then the other technology, which we use a lot to study more common diseases, which is much cheaper, is genotyping arrays. So these are basically like a little glass slide on which you can measure what version of a particular letter people have at, say, 500,000 positions in the genome that we know to commonly vary between people. So that just looks at a subset of the variation. So you look at maybe a few hundred thousand of these genetic variants rather than millions of them in an individual genome. But there's still a lot you can learn from the patterns that you can measure on those arrays, and they only cost about £20 now, as opposed to £300 plus for whole genome sequencing. So that's how we measure it. So for studying diseases, a pretty typical design for common diseases is to have a bunch of people with the disease and a bunch of people without the disease, and to look at each of those several hundred thousand genetic variants that you've measured on one of these arrays and compare how common they are between your cases and controls, and then apply some statistics and find those that are significantly different. And that tells you that somewhere in the genome near that genetic variant is another variant which is influencing risk of the disease. For rare diseases, that design is sometimes used as well, but there's also designs that are kind of within families. So if you have a disease that is very rare and typically you just have one affected individual in a family, and if the disease is early onset, then a common design is to take trios where you have a bunch of children who have the disease and whose parents don't, and you look for new mutations that have occurred in the egg or sperm of those parents and are seen in the children at a rate higher than we expect by chance. And I won't get into details of how we calculate that expectation. But anyway, that's a bit of a different design.
And just, I guess, thinking about those rare diseases. So these are generally conditions which follow the sorts of the patterns of inheritance that one learns about at school. Dominant inheritance and, as you say, sometimes dominant conditions that start for the first time in a child, or sometimes recessive, again another pattern that people will have to be familiar with from school and so on. Give us an idea for some of the challenges in, like, it sounds sort of easy if you think back to schools, like you just look at a particular part of the genome, you look for a variation and Bob's your uncle, you've got the answer. What makes it so hard? What are we, I guess, one of the things I'm really aware of as a clinician practicing in genetics is that how much variation there is between any two of us, and the challenge of sort of picking out, if you like, the needle from the haystack across our whole genome of variation that is, you know, is rare and also you can be confident is relevant to that person's condition. Tell us a bit about how that plays out for you.
Yes, so some challenges in rare disease genetics. I mean, I guess a major one for the sorts of diseases that we work on, which are rare developmental disorders that have very early onset, is they're extremely heterogeneous, and patients with causal mutations in the same gene might have quite different clinical traits. And so you're not necessarily going to know a priori that this set of five patients in the UK all have exactly the same super rare condition. And so that has been successful in the past for many rare disorders that are quite sort of clinically homogeneous and distinct, I guess. Now I think there's been a bit of a refocus on collecting large cohorts of patients with a sort of heterogeneous set of conditions and just saying, are there genes which enrich for a particular type of rare variant in this set of people compared to controls or compared to expectation. At least that's the approach that we've been taking in the deciphering developmental disorder study. And that's been very fruitful for finding new genes that give rise to really heterogeneous conditions. I guess a major challenge is just that a lot of these disorders are super rare. And so to have power to implicate genes, you need very large sample sizes. Increasingly now we're trying to bring together samples from multiple different cohorts, and there are practical challenges in doing that to do with data security, what data you're allowed to share on patients, how to kind of standardize your analysis across different cohorts if you can't physically move the data and so on. Does that give you a flavor?
It does. And I guess one of the things to say sort of about the work you've described, again, from sort of my perspective as a clinician, is like how powerful it has been over the last years. The number of families that you've actually helped by making diagnoses through, say, the deciphering developmental disorders study, the work of you and others in the 100,000 Genomes Project, finding new diagnoses which just wouldn't be there. And like the enormous impact that has for families, where
for many years. It's just been because of that, you say there's a heterogeneity, the sort of the challenge of knowing, you know, what the cause was in many of these families.
That's good to hear. I mean, I can't personally take very much credit for diagnosing a large number of individual patients, but I have contributed strongly to a few of them. And it's sometimes you sort of think, oh, you find something and you think, oh, why didn't this come through the pipeline? This looked like it should be diagnostic. And sort of sorting that out requires, you know, 20 emails and digging back into 5-year-old code and so on. And you think, oh, God, this is, you know, such a hassle. I should really be pressing on with my next analysis. Then you have to remember, actually, if this is the right diagnosis, this could make a huge difference to one poor family somewhere. So we do try and pursue those cases. And, you know, of course, some are easier in the sense that they pop out naturally from kind of cohort-wide analyses that we're doing. But it's always good to know about the clinical impact of the work.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that we see, and like that your description of the 20 emails is absolutely on the nail. And I guess one of the things we try to do, and I know has been done at the DDD study before, is like do both sides, both make sure the benefit is there for that individual family, but also think about how that can benefit others. So whether it's making the same diagnosis in other families that suddenly you know about and can make. And secondly, also, as you say, like learn about what it was in the sort of the pipeline, the automated system that generally we use to support the lab diagnostic teams.
Yeah.
To make it better so that next time it doesn't need someone with their research team to add to the chance that you'll actually find it. So I guess that's some of the sort of, that's given us a nice idea of some of the sort of general challenges. As we mentioned, you worked on sort of a number of diverse cohorts. You mentioned the East London Genes in Health, and I know that you're also working with the Born in Bradford team and cohort. Tell us about some of that work that you're doing on more diverse populations and how that fits into the work more generally.
Sure. So I became interested in this partly through my work on deciphering developmental disorders, where I worked on recessive diseases. So these are diseases where you have to inherit a damaging mutation in the same gene from both parents in order to be affected. And those are much more common when you have consanguinity, so where the parents are related. And the two largest ancestry groups within this developmental disorders cohort are white British individuals and British Pakistanis. And we saw that the British Pakistanis had a much higher burden of recessive diseases, and it was kind of already known that consanguinity was quite common in the British Pakistani community. So we went to the Born in Bradford cohort, which has a high fraction of individuals with British Pakistani ancestry, to study these patterns of consanguinity further in a healthy population, essentially healthy, and also to look at the population structure, and in particular to look at the impact of what's called the Biradari system, which is a little bit, well, it's kind of like the Indian caste system. And we were interested in this partly just because we're interested in the structure and history of populations, but also because we know that understanding that can be important for doing well-designed medical genetic studies, and also for maybe telling you about some unique features of populations which could be relevant for their disease risk and that you might want to take advantage of in order to more easily find genes underlying disease in those populations. So we have got a paper that's just about in press, and it which is on the bioarchive, looking at the population structure, history, and consanguinity patterns of British Pakistanis using about 2,000 plus British Pakistanis from Born in Bradford. And that's been really fascinating. Essentially, we've seen that this Biradari system, which has had a major influence on marriage patterns for the last few hundred or even a couple of thousands of years, has had a pretty big impact on the distribution of genetic variation. So there are some groups that are clearly distinguishable from each other genetically and others that are more mixed. We've also developed a new algorithm to infer the degree of parental relatedness for an individual, so how related are their parents, just using the genetic data. And then we compared those inferences to self-reported information about consanguinity and saw some very interesting patterns there. We also looked at how consanguinity versus the endogamy, so intra-Baradri marriage, impacts the risk of recessive disorders, because these processes of marrying a close relative versus marrying someone who's not a close relative but from the same kind of close-knit community, they have kind of similar impact qualitatively on risk of these recessive diseases, and we tried to quantify that. So that's been a really interesting project, and we've worked quite closely with some members of the Pakistani community in Bradford to interpret those findings and put them in context of what's known from the historical and ethnographic literature.
That sounds both sort of scientifically really sort of important, but also like potentially, as you say, having benefit for advice that could be given to individual families or families from that community.
I think it's probably a little bit early to be giving advice. We want to kind of extend this project into rare disease cohorts to look at the relative impact of consanguinity versus endogamy on rare disease risk. But before we do that, we're doing some community engagement to find out people's views about this research, because we know these are quite sensitive topics, and, you know, find out if people think it's important and worthwhile, and if so, how we can best present it to the community in a culturally sensitive way. So definitely too early to start giving any advice, but, you know, we would like to be in a position to be able to do that for future research.
And tell us about some of those discussions. We at Genomics England know the Born in Bradford team relatively well now, and are looking to partner with them on, again, sort of seeing how we can support research like yours. One of the things that I found really striking about them as a group and as a cohort is how much time and thought they put into making sure that this is a program about the community. And one of the things I really enjoy about that sort of work and the work we do at Genomics England is like having participants really driving the conversation, which often as a doctor or as a scientist, that's historically at least not been so much part of it. So tell us a bit about your experience of doing that sort of engaging with some of the families or participants in the Born in Bradford work you've done.
So for that most recent project I just told you about regarding the population genetics of British Pakistanis, we've had a really good collaboration with a couple of Pakistani research fellows from the Bradford Institute for Health Research, including Sufyan Dogra, who's an anthropologist who told us a lot about the Baradri system and the history. He also brought in a couple of other local Pakistani leaders from Bradford to weigh in about what was known about the history of some of the different groups. It was actually really difficult to find this information from credible sources in English. So it wouldn't have been nearly such an interesting study if we hadn't interacted with them, because we wouldn't have known how to interpret our findings. So that's been extremely stimulating.
That sounds great. And I know that you've also been doing some work on common disease and the transferability of some of the tools, the so-called polygenic risk scoring between different populations. Maybe you could just start by sort of painting a sort of brief picture of what we mean by polygenic risk and what some of the questions are you've been trying to tease out.
Sure. So when I mentioned earlier that in studies of common disease, we typically take a bunch of people with a disease and a bunch of people without a disease and compare the frequency of hundreds of thousands or a few million genetic variants across the genome between those two groups. And if we find variants of different frequency, then those are pointing at a region of the genome that's implicated in risk of that disease. So those are called genome-wide association studies. And polygenic scores take the findings from those studies, and they basically allow us to calculate a score for each individual, which is a measure of their degree of genetic risk of a particular disease or a trait. So basically you measure which letter they have at each position in the genome that you've found to be linked to the trait, and you sum those up weighted by the effect size on the trait. And those scores show a lot of promise for potential use in the clinic for some diseases, for example, for predicting which individuals might be at very high risk of heart disease and should be put on statins earlier, for example, or high risk of breast cancer and should have earlier mammograms. But one of the problems with them is that they are mostly developed in European ancestry cohorts, and they don't tend to work as well in non-European ancestry cohorts. So we've used a cohort of British South Asians to study comprehensively how well the scores for the polygenic scores for cardiometabolic traits transport from European ancestry individuals into South Asian ancestry individuals. And the cohort's called Genes and Health, formerly East London Genes and Health. It's now got about 48,000 individuals with Pakistani and Bangladeshi ancestry enrolled with genetic data and linked electronic health records. So it's a really fantastic resource. And this population has a very high burden of cardiometabolic disease. And we found, for example, that for some traits, actually, these polygenic scores derived in Europeans work pretty much equally well in British Pakistanis, like scores for blood pressure and some lipid traits. Whereas for other diseases and traits, they worked rather less well, up to kind of 50% less well, like BMI and heart disease. So we did a comprehensive evaluation of this, and then we did a bit of exploration about why some scores transported well and others less well. To be honest, we didn't actually really manage to answer that question very well. There didn't seem to be a kind of obvious systematic differences in other genetic measures that we made between those traits. But we did a bunch of other exploration of which specific genetic variants ascertained in Europeans also seemed to be contributing to risk in the South Asians. And the answer was pretty much all of them. There's very high overlap. Yeah. And then another part of the analysis was focused on how useful are these scores clinically, even if they don't perform as well as they do in Europeans. Are they still useful for predicting cardiovascular disease risk in South Asians on top of existing clinical risk factors that are already used? And we found that actually they do help on top of something called the Q risk score, which is a clinical risk score. And that had been looked at and shown in Europeans, but we kind of showed this in South Asians. And it suggests that there will be some clinical utility in employing these scores to predict risk and potentially identify individuals at very high risk, even if the scores are not totally optimal. But the work definitely indicates that it would be useful to do more big genetic studies in people with South Asian ancestry, which will improve the predictive accuracy of these scores.
That's fascinating. And I guess one of the sort of themes underlying this is that historically, the populations who've been most studied from a genomic point of view and included in various research studies, et cetera, over the years have been based in Europe or North America, and therefore biased in terms of sort of what ancestral populations they include. It's fascinating to hear how on, I guess, both of these bits that you're talking about born in Bradford and you're talking about your work with Genes in Health, how what is like a zoom in on like two very specific questions into, I guess, really quite specific populations tells you, you know, in great detail, you know, something a bit more about different areas of health. And I guess to me, it exposes how much room there is for more work like this in different populations. And I guess so many different lessons if we want to start for, as you know, using some of the learnings to give advice to families, the level of confidence that you need before you can do that is relatively high, and just, you know, shows how important some really detailed, thoughtful research like yours is to do that.
Well, we hope it will have some clinical use one day, but of course it's a long road. Yeah,
I guess it'd be really interesting to hear, you know, in both cases you've partnered with particular cohorts who are ongoing and established. What the areas are where, you know, if you had a sort of a magic wand in terms of being able to answer some of these questions about sort of making the what we know about impact of genomics in health more generalizable across communities, what the big picture is that we should be sort of shooting for, what the things that you would wish for to do the analyses you'd want?
Yeah, well, I could point at a few things. One of the challenges that we came across in this project on polygenic risk in genes and health was that we didn't have European ancestry cohort that was collected in exactly the same way as the genes and health cohort. And so we compared to an American cohort, which is also based on electronic health records, but the recruitment strategy was a bit different there. The age distribution was different. Some of the diseases are ascertained and recorded differently in the health records. We didn't necessarily have access to information about, say, lipid-lowering drugs, which are important to control for. And so something I realized from that is it's most valuable to have cohorts with people that have different ancestries collected in the same place in exactly the same way, so that you assure that differences you see between the ancestry groups are not due to differences in how the disease has been measured or the socioeconomic status or the age distribution, for example, which we know can affect performance of polygenic scores. So that would be really valuable. But of course, you know, in most countries where there's large-scale funding for this, ethnic minority populations are, by definition, minorities. And so in order to collect enough people in a given healthcare system from that ethnic minority background, you really have to oversample those people. And so you need to have good public engagement programs to persuade them to participate and reassure them that you're going to look after their data responsibly and so on. So those are some of the things I learned. Then I guess another point is just that, you know, there are quite a lot of cohorts that have some ethnic diversity, but often the non-Europeans are left out because the sample size is just too small to bother doing anything with, or because you don't have a good reference cohort of that ancestry group, so you can't get good estimates of allele frequencies, the frequency of these particular genetic variants, which is really important, particularly in rare diseases. So we need those reference cohorts of healthy people from different ancestry groups to compare against. And we also need to have a good sense of their population structure, because often people talk about Africans or South Asians as an ancestry group. But of course, there's huge diversity within those. And if you kind of ignore that, you can get completely wrong estimates of the frequency of these genetic variants, which can have strong implications for downstream analyses. So those are some pointers. And then just a final point is that family-based studies are particularly valuable in this context, because when you do these genetic association studies to find genes for disease, it's really important to control for population structure so that your cases and controls, say, don't have systematically different ancestries. But in cases where you can't collect a lot of people from the same ancestry, you might not be able to do that so well. But if you have data on people from families, there are other ways you can kind of get around that. And so family data could be particularly valuable in circumstances where you're studying individuals from an ethnic minority.
Fascinating. So, Hilary, thank you for joining us. Thank you for the work that you're doing to make diagnoses for individual families, but also the more general learnings and also the really sort of thoughtful approach you've taken, particularly on these questions about making sure that our knowledge on genomics is relevant to all communities. Thank you very much for joining us on the podcast. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you today.
Thank you. It's been a fun discussion.
That's all for this episode. Thanks for listening to this discussion about the G word and for joining us on this journey to highlight and debate the implications of genomics as it comes to the mainstream of healthcare and society. Remember to subscribe to the G word on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. If you have views on these topics, if you have a suggestion for someone we should interview, then do write to us at podcast@genomicsengland.co.uk. And do remember, if you've enjoyed listening, that giving us a 5-star review really helps other people find out about this series. I'd appreciate it very much. I've been Rich Scott. See you on the next episode of The G Word.